Welcome to Voices of the Valley, a series interviewing growers, entrepreneurs, educators, and technologists who are inventing new solutions for today's and tomorrow's challenges on the farm. Brought to you by Reedley College, educating the next generation of agriculturalists in advanced technology, efficient production practices, and food safety. Now here's your hosts of Voices of the Valley, Dennis Donahue and Candace Wilson.
This is Dennis Donahue, the director of Western Growers Center of Innovation and Technology and co-host with my good friend Candace Wilson of the weekly episode of Voices of the Valley. Candace, how are you?
I'm doing well, minus this crazy cold that I have. I know I sound a little funny today.
Well, we'll know it's you. You know, we've set them straight right at the beginning. So anyway, good to see you as always. And we're going to go across the pond today. We got a good friend and somebody I'm really looking forward to visiting with, Belinda Clark, who is the director of Agritech E. Help us get situated. This doesn't sound like London. So where are you? And tell us a little bit about kind of your career background, all leading to Agritech E, and then we'll get into what that's all about.
Okay, well, what a pleasure to be here in the Valley virtually with you. I'm calling from the flatlands of the UK in the Fens, which is the east of England, a very highly agriculturally productive area, particularly for vegetables and some cereals and potatoes and sugar beet as well. So we're about 150 kilometers from London. So we're surrounded by lots of farmers, and I've got some alpacas and sheep at the back of my house as well. So I know what it's like to be a livestock producer that makes a very low margin, low value, but very beautiful product. So thank you for the introduction, Dennis. My background is I'm a scientist by background, so I can be very boring about how peas and potatoes make starch, if you'll indulge me. But for that reason, I guess, I decided quite early on in my career to move away from research. And I was really passionate at an early age about seeing how science can really do the job it was designed to do and help farmers. So that fire was ignited in me when I was a research technician, actually, on leaving school. And I could see that there was this great research that just wasn't getting out to farmers. So that kind of made it my mission in life. And 20 years later, I'm lucky enough to run this organization. We've now been in our ninth year, called Agritech E, which is really an innovation ecosystem for agritech, bringing together growers and farmers, technology developers, and researchers.
You know, and I certainly encourage folks to look at your website. I'm always impressed every time I do. So talk about how all of that takes place, because one of the things I've been impressed by is there's a lot of substance standing behind what you just said. I mean, it really sounds like a highly functioning organization that really has excelled in getting people together towards that objective you just laid out. So talk a little bit about how you work and some of the things you do.
So I guess a number of the ways that we bring that community together is around events. And we try and host events around topics that we think will resonate with both farmers and technology developers. So we do those, and they have always been in person. Then the pandemic hit and we ran, I think, just over 50 odd events online. In fact, we did one with the Western Growers Association, right, Didn't we? Where we were showcasing some of the needs of your growers to the UK technology community. So there's events, there's kind of one-to-one or one-to-many brokerage. So we will introduce people to who have either solutions or challenges to those who perhaps have the other side of the equation. If they're farmers with a challenge, we can hopefully find a technologist with the solution. And technologists are often looking for farmers to help ground truth their thinking or trial a technology or whatever. So it's really just kind of bringing that ecosystem together, helping to articulate the challenge at the right level of granularity. I think that's really important, because if you ask a lot of farmers what they want, they might give you a very top level description. On the other hand, you might get into a very detailed discussion of specifically what they need. And just matching the expectation of both timescale, ambition of what needs doing, the complexity of what needs doing, is that we kind of curate that conversation, I guess.
Well, one of the things, and you know, we're at the beginning of the new year, and our previous guest, we talked a little bit about, you know, we wanted to talk about what lies ahead, where priorities are. But in the midst of that, you know, there was kind of an acknowledgement of there is a bit of growers fatigue. Is that same phenomena taking place in your world, or just kind of a steady go? There's a lot of exciting things going on. And so that's question number one. Are you finding that to be the case in your neck of the woods? And then what's your general outlook in 2023 in terms of you know, what are growers and investors thinking about most prominently these days in your world?
So the grower fatigue question is very interesting. And I think if we view the farming and grower community almost as a bell curve, so there will be those at the leading edge of that bell curve that want to know what's coming through. They just have this appetite for technology, either because they're personally interested or they feel that that's a key enabler for the growth of their business. There's then, I think, possibly a larger group who are, I think, very positive and hopeful at what technology can deliver, but perhaps have seen quite a lot of solutions and are maybe a little bit jaded with, you know, this constant barrage, as you say, of opportunities coming their way. But I think possibly need support in being able to triage those opportunities. And then I think there's a sort of tailing edge of that bell curve, who are the ones who are the more difficult ones to get engaged. And frankly, I think possibly to move on a little bit to your second question, times are tough. Times are really tough for growers for a number of reasons we can perhaps come on to. And I'm not suggesting that technology is a panacea or a silver bullet by any means, but I think those that still have their heads in the sand about the change that is coming perhaps have a shock waiting for them. So I think there will be fewer of those laggards, we might call them, rather disingenuously, given the pressure that is on the industry at the moment. And as I say, technology is, I think, a key enabler. It's not the only solution, but if you're disregarding tech, then I think that's perhaps at your peril.
You know, your organization, even though it's agritech-y and kind of implies a certain geographic focus in the UK, you certainly have a global reach, global impact. You know, for instance, your REAP conferences, you've got folks from all over the world paying attention to what's going on in Great Britain. You know, obviously we've all had to deal with COVID, and then you've had Brexit. And so what's really the general backdrop? So when you talk about what's coming, I assume some of that's connected to the situation in the UK specifically.
Yeah, I think there's two tiers. So I guess just to pick up your point. So Agritech E, we kind of laughingly say E stands for expanding, evolving and everywhere. So we have members across the UK and internationally. So hopefully the E doesn't implies omnipotence rather than any geographic
Hence, that's why you changed it from East to E. You didn't want to limit yourself anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah, I still have that East floating in my mind.
Exactly.
So, all right.
Yeah, I think we have two tiers. Somebody said to me the other day, there's unprecedented use of the word unprecedented when it comes to talking about agriculture, particularly in the UK. So we have had Brexit, which, let's be clear, has been a seismic disruptor to the industry in a number of ways. And certainly those who, you know, move product across borders, whether that's ag chem, whether it's food products, you know, we had awful stories of lorries being held up at Dover trying to get across to Europe or back the other way. So that's been incredibly challenging. And the strength of the pound, we've had some political instability, shall we call it, over the last year that sort of has resulted from some of that. And there's been a bit of a lack of confidence and clarity. There's some policy drivers that were announced as a result of Brexit. So, for example, our farmers were part of the European Common Agricultural Policy. And when we came out of Europe as a country, the British government started this mantra of public money for public goods. And that implied that farmers would be paid, reimbursed, incentivized to deliver ecosystem services. So kind of soils, health, water, clean air, biodiversity, net gain, all of these things. And it's taken a while for that to start to rumble through. And there was a bit of a wobble a few months ago where there was a sense that maybe government was reining back on that direction of travel. Now, I think we're back on track. There was the big Oxford Farming Conference last week where the government did reinstate and reinforce their commitment to this ELMS, as it's called, the Environmental Land Management Scheme. But that's really that lack of clarity in policy has really contributed to a bit of a reluctance to commit to a direction of travel as a grower or a farm manager or even a landowner. You know, should I be prioritizing yield and productivity given supply chain issues due to Ukraine? Or should I be prioritizing environmental parameters given that I think the government, the British government, will incentivize me and reimburse me to do that? Or can I, as I think is starting to happen, can I move both of those agendas forward? Can I be highly productive and environmentally benign as well? And it's taken a while for that mindset to crystallize, I think.
That's interesting that the government would incentivize and compensate for, you know, the environmental benefit.
Absolutely. I'm curious, can we go back to the bell curve also that you were explaining about there being this a group of growers that is looking for, basically looking for more information, looking for more guidance. Maybe they are not the ones leading. There's this group in the middle. And yeah. Who should be supporting them? Or in your world, who's helping them kind of get over that hump?
That's a really great question, Candice. And it's quite difficult. So if you go back to the kind of post-war years in the UK, there was the man from the ministry would come onto your farm, would give you advice, would support you to, you know, increase productivity because there was, you know, food rationing shortages during the war. And there was a lot of publicly funded support for farmers to adopt what was at the time viewed as best practice. I mean, with the lens of history, we might think that perhaps is not certainly the most environmentally good way to farm, but that was the advice that farmers were being given. Now, that public information and support and advice for government stopped quite a long time ago. And a lot of that sits now in the hands of the private sector. And a number of agronomists, for example, may be allied to a particular chemical distributor company. And I personally don't think this is the case, but there's that sort of allegation that perhaps they might not be completely independent because they're trying to sell chemical as well as give you advice. Now, I think that is a slightly disingenuous view, but the fact remains that the two, the advice and my ability to sell you chemical and make money from you through that sale, are very tightly linked. So agronomists are quite trusted. The independent ones, I think, when you look at surveys, are more trusted than those who, you know, may be perceived to have an agenda. As I say, not necessarily fair, but that is the perception. The role of the public sector to help farmers triage technologies is quite tricky. And it's one that the British government is still trying to, I think, wrap its arms around, because it's quite tricky when there are a number of potentially quite similar solutions out there for government to, it's anti-competitive for one thing, to say, you know, pick companies A's solution over company B's solution. And particularly at the moment, for example, carbon accounting and carbon management, there's a view that farmers are going to be reimbursed for carbon sequestration. And the farmers are saying, so tell us how you're going to measure it, government. How are you going to measure our success at doing this? Tell us the methodology you're going to use. And I think the answer is that there will potentially be a number of different methodologies, and it will be your own delta, you know, your quantum of change that you can show on your farm, rather than using a single, you know, so-called gold standard tool. I'm minded of, I hosted a group of Chinese agronomists a while ago, and they said, you know, how does your government decide what farmers grow and what tools they use and what equipment and what chemicals? And I said, well, government doesn't tell them that. And they said, what? You mean farmers just have to work it out for themselves, what they grow and how they grow it and what they use? And I said, yeah, kind of put like that. It sounds a bit like the Wild West.
Boy, that's interesting.
Wild West and wild freedom. Both. Exactly.
There you go. You know, and maybe your answers are a bit of a segue, but semi-related. You know, Europe has a lot of influence on, you know, the regulatory environment. And then obviously, you know, ag is a global game. So, the UK is a market for a lot of products, you know, almonds, et cetera, et cetera. The question I have is, what is the impact, because eventually this gets to the US, of companies like Marks and Spencer, Bakkavor, you know, Tesco, that sort of thing, because their agendas certainly impact the marketplace. Where are you sensing they're coming down on these issues, and what's their impact going to be on your grower base?
Yeah, that's a very live conversation at the moment. You know, the retailers have always, and indeed the processors, but more so the retailers have always had, you know, a very strong and influential role in the supply chain for reasons that we know about. And not all retailers are equal in this, in terms of, you know, what they ask of their growers, in terms of auditing things like animal welfare, you know, the way that crops are managed, attention to the environment, things like that. It is a live question, because the retailers, given that I think we probably all accept that food is too cheap, has been too cheap for a long time. Now, food costs are going up, and I wouldn't wish to disregard the fact that that is causing a large proportion of society globally big problems, that food prices are going up. But overall, as a proportion of household income, certainly in the UK and Europe, it is very small and food has been too cheap for too long. Growers have not been paid cost of production across some verticals, and that's not acceptable. But the retailers broadly are quite reluctant to pass on any increases that would be required, you know, increasing costs as a result of, you know, higher welfare or, you know, enhanced management practices. They don't want to pass that on to their customers. Now, in fairness, some of them are absorbing those costs themselves for now, but there is this worry that it's going to be passed back up the value chain and it's going to end up with the farmers taking the risk, having to carry the can for the increased demands of the retailer slash consumer. And I put the slash in there advisedly because, you know, the retailers say we ask for what our consumers want, but consumers want what the retailers provide. So it's a bit of a vicious circle, I personally think.
You know, Belinda, I'm writing down questions I'm going to ask you, but I'm getting some phrases that I'm going to use going forward. I like carry the can, and I made a note of wobbly. So so I appreciate that. Before we jump into you know, the conversation about water and your upcoming conference, you know, I always like to tell people I Googled you or I Googled your website. And, you know, I was just looking at your slate of activities and I was really intrigued by, and interestingly enough, because something that's going on in Monterey County, space tech meets agritech and plans for a new space cluster and the connection with ag. And I found that particularly interesting because in Monterey County, there's an emerging cluster around the fact Joby Aviation is in nearby Marina, and then six counties have gotten together. And so if you extend down to the Lompoc area, you've got Vandenberg Air Force Base. So in terms of getting ready for the future, drones, air mobility, I found that interesting. So when I saw that space tech meets agritech concept, I was really intrigued about that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, this is an event that we're running the week after next, actually. There's an ambition within Norfolk and Suffolk, which are two of the major counties in the east of England, and arguably sort of part of the breadbasket of the UK, if you want to put it like that. A lot of prime agricultural land, about 40% of the UK's grade one agricultural land is in the east of England, and a lot of it in Norfolk and Suffolk. And for a number of reasons, there's thinking that the geography, the terrain, a number of factors around Norfolk and Suffolk make it particularly well placed to have a space tech cluster. There's already a kind of kernel, a sort of nascent number of companies. There's some research at the university, some engineering capability, and of course, a huge amount of agriculture. There's also a large coastline around a lot of Norfolk and Suffolk. So being able to use space technologies for aquaculture and the marine environment as well, coastal management, there's a lot of things that could feed in, as well as, of course, transport, logistics. There's the port of Felixstowe in Suffolk as well. So there are a lot of sectors in that geography that could feed into the space conversation. Now, of course, we're leading on the agriculture bit of that conversation. And it just, you know, when you sit down and think about how space enabled the average farm is, you know, you've got GPS technology on your tractor. Maybe you've got robots being controlled by satellite. You've got visualization technology and imaging, yield prediction, forecasting, weather forecasting. There's actually, you think, well, heck, how do people manage to farm before we had the space revolution? So we're just going to be unpacking that a little bit. We're going to be looking at investment opportunities for space tech in agriculture. We're having what we call a space safari, where we've got some companies that are using space tech in agriculture, and delegates will be moving around the room, kind of talking to these companies that are going to be doing little mini pop-up presentations about their tech and how they're helping farmers map field boundaries accurately, for example, or track livestock, or even track a big piece of equipment that when it gets stolen, you can then track where it's, you know, being taken to. So yeah, farms are really space enabled. And we just wanted to take a bit of a deeper dive into that, really to help build the business case for a cluster.
Well, and you know, that approach, and I think what's exciting about it is it creates excitement around ag tech and really give folks a really unique perspective, because, you know, we've, and I think you and I have had this conversation, Candace and I have certainly been involved in a number of conversations and events about attracting the next generation of ag workers. And the reality is we're all sectors are going to be competing for STEM-based talent. So if we're going to be competitive, I think we've got to be exciting as well. And this is just really kind of a unique marriage. So I was really intrigued when I saw that.
And also what we'd like to do is, you know, we want to make agriculture a very welcoming sector for those in other industries, whether it's automotive or aerospace or defense or mining or material science, healthcare even. You know, we want them to lean into agriculture, but they don't know what the route to market is. What are the opportunities? Who do they sell to in the supply chain? So we at AgriTechE are kind of providing a soft landing for companies from other industries. And of course, the space industry, they might be, you know, putting satellites up for something completely different. And we can say, here's this other new opportunity, other new market for you. So as well as making it sexy for the individuals, we want to make it sexy for companies to have a robust business case to look at agriculture and bring their validated technology to our industry.
I love what you guys are doing and the concept. And I also want to ask you a question that's kind of in a different vein. Last week, we were with another guest, Shauna Day, and what she talked about was, as she looks ahead to future years, she feels like there has been so much investment in the technology product space for agriculture, and that there's a huge, and this is the sexy space, to your point. It's kind of what draws the attention in, and people are excited and energized around agriculture and the potential of what this industry has and how far we need to go. However, there's been this miss. This is her perception and her prediction. There's been this miss around agriculture services focused on products, but how can we help the grower in terms of services? And she used a handful of examples, and I just want to get your feedback on this opinion, but examples of HR processes. We have lots of regulatory restrictions and needs of needing to report information back. How can companies start to emerge in this services space and allow growers to do what they do best while taking off some of these administrative responsibilities, is kind of what I'm going to call them? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I guess this goes back to Dennis's sort of fatigue point, is that I don't, if I'm a grower, I might not want to see yet another sexy harvesting robot. What I might want to do is just have somebody that's going to take some of the heavy lifting off all my office-based tools and jobs that I have to do. And I think I would completely agree with last week's guest that I think there's, you know, innovation is not just about in-field technology. It's around business processes. It's around mindset. You know, innovation is around just doing stuff differently. And we can go down this sort of technology rabbit hole if we're not careful, but an innovative business model can be even more transformational than, you know, another shiny bit of kit.
So don't you think that's a great quote? Shauna's going to want to quote you in her, you know, in her publication. That was fantastic.
She can have it. And I think that there is a role for where technology can help with these. So for example, you know, blockchain has had a bit of a bad rep, but, you know, distributed ledger technologies that can help with audit trails around, you know, movement of product practices, you know, ensuring good welfare practices. I think Unilever was doing something with some tea growers in Malawi to establish good economic practices. And that was all stored in the blockchain as a distributed ledger. So, you know, you can't change it. It's there. It is what it is. So I think we can use technology to support that service industry. But yes, absolutely. Let's not only view innovation as a sexy new bit of kit. It's a necessary but not sufficient definition of the word innovation, I would argue.
Before we jump into the water conference and the water conversation, I want to take advantage of your background, something you and I have chatted about. One of the things that's also in the horizon this year is a lot of conversations about biologicals. So, you know, the framing of that is less chemistry, more biology. What are you seeing happen? How fast is it going to happen? Just what's your general take? And I was at an event recently a couple of weeks ago, and for the first time, I also heard the phrase plant health technology, you know, in terms of taking advantage of some of the on-the-ground equipment that are performing various functions, let's say thinning and weeding, but those frankly are also the perfect vehicles from a data library standpoint to look at pests, to identify diseases and that sort of thing. Where are we in that whole world as things move forward? It seems to me there's going to be a real pickup in activity there.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there was a narrative, I guess, sort of 5-8 years ago that the next agricultural revolution was going to be data driven. And I think that's right, but hand in hand with biology. And so I think there's two ways of answering that. So there is an enhanced awareness and understanding of the role of being able to harness nature's own sort of ag chem arsenal to be able to improve the biodiversity on farm, to increase beneficial insects, increase soil microbial content, and just harness and enhance nature's own way of doing stuff. You know, keep your rotations nice and broad, don't have them too tight, make sure that nature can do her own thing to help with increased biology and hence productivity and environmental value. Then the second piece of that is, can you bring in new products and services to either introduce new biologics or to augment those that are already there? So I think the first one we're seeing with the sort of regenerative agriculture movement. I don't know if, are you hearing this in the Valley and in Salinas? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a connection. The conversations connect.
Yeah. So the whole kind of regen approach is around enhancing nature's own biology. When it comes to the companies that are developing biologicals to apply to plants, animals, soils, that's when it's starting to become a little bit more complicated, because huge interest, huge demand, but Mother Nature is a cruel mistress when it comes to trying to do robust scientific experiments on some of these products. And I don't like, and I'm not going to use the phrase snake oil, but, you know, nature likes to not likes a sort of equilibrium. And when you start putting in too many of one thing, and it destabilizes things in ways you can't predict. And it's, I think it's really difficult. And the regulators are certainly finding it very difficult to regulate around. You're nodding, so I'm guessing you're seeing the same thing in the US. It's really hard because nature is, by definition, you know, does her own thing and might not behave as you expect it to. So short answer to your question, a lot of interest, a lot of excitement, still trying to nail some of the really tight regulatory parameters. Although that said, there are companies making a good living around being able to, you know, enhance particular soil microbial communities, a lot of increased understanding of what's going on around the rhizosphere, around crops. Can we do something that will, you know, increase the bacteria, the microbes, the microfauna, animals that are in the soil? But it's hard. It's really hard, both to innovate and then to get a product to market in this space.
All right.
One of the challenges that I'm hearing here, Dennis, I'm sure this is kind of a common theme in the conversations you're having too, is in this space, just how challenging it is to really measure the progress, and how challenging it is to, it's hard to say one season, this is the result that I saw. It's hard to isolate the product performance. And so it really is going to be this a longer term play on the science and data gathering to truly understand the impact of some of these new, you know, biological inputs on the soils. So there's like this hesitation from our grower community where it's like a recognition that this is likely the right thing to do and I need to be part of it, but an additional cost that we're doing, an additional something, you know, that's on my to-do list without being able to see a year-to-year sort of gain in the short term.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely spot on, Candace. And without wanting to kind of try and codify what is absolutely perfect description of what's happening, for me, I think it comes down to almost a bit of a tension between this sort of systems approach that farmers are now being encouraged to take about the way they're farming. You know, let's look at the whole system. Let's look at the soils, the plants, the microbes, the environment, as all as a kind of holistic integrated whole. But then you need to almost take a very reductionist approach, you know, and be very sort of scientifically rigorous about it, that we'll keep everything else constant, but we'll change one variable, like all good scientists do, and then see what the impact is. And those two are really difficult to reconcile, because you can't be holistic and integrative and then be reductionist enough to look at what might be cumulative year on year changes. So you might not see an impact on your, you know, soil organic carbon for 5 years, say. Right. So it's really tough, a really tough thing to navigate. And I love the way you phrased that. I think that was spot on.
Well, I think one thing everybody is in agreement on, you know, the ship is sailing in that direction of less chemistry, more biology. So, you know, one of the things we're very intent on is laying things out as neatly as you have. So thank you for that. I want to jump into you've got another big event. You do events well, and this is an important one. Now, it never would have occurred to me that the United Kingdom was worried about water. We know it's a global issue. So it sounds like you've got the same challenges the rest of the world does on this. So talk about the event you're going to have and what you're addressing and how you're addressing it.
Sure. So I think when you talk to farmers about what they're worried about, they can give you a very long list. And water is usually quite high up near the top of that list. Not enough of it, too much of it, in the wrong place at the wrong time. So there's been some serious flood challenges. You know, there's now the UK is a tiny island. There's a lot of building on, you know, what has historically been floodplains, really. And it's madness. You know, the east of England and where I live in the Fens, we're actually a little bit below sea level. So we have a pumping system. When the Fens were drained several hundred years ago, fresh water is actually pumped out to sea in order to keep the water levels low enough. And yet in the summer, farmers are irrigating because there isn't enough water. The Environment Agency that sort of controls abstraction licenses from the water course in the UK is really tightening up. There are growers who are losing their abstraction licenses, so they will not have enough water. So if you don't have a reservoir on your farm and you don't have, you know, availability of water, that is going to seriously impact your business. On the other hand, we have terrible floods. You know, the Somerset Plains, we've had, you know, really devastating floods. So we have too much at the wrong time, in the wrong place, and not enough. So we need to get better at recycling, storing, reusing, reducing things like drip irrigation. I mean, even the farmers that have installed drip are still, you know, seriously challenged. And just to bring it back again to the east of England, there's been a big report that suggests that we're going to lose, I think, 17% of the water that is currently available for agriculture in coming years, because the Environment Agency is tightening up. You know, we all as consumers need to reduce our consumption. And this is a real problem for farmers. So it's almost kind of technology meets behavior change meets policy. And so what we want to unpack at our event, which is coming up on February the 8th, we're going to hold it at Cranfield University, which is one of the UK's leading research centres into water resource management in agriculture in particular, and look at, you know, what are the options. You know, we've got some technology companies, and I know you know one of them, Dennis, that they've been associated with the Western Growers Incubator for a while, looking at solutions like drip irrigation, like desalinization, material science, where there's composites that you can add as a soil conditioner to increase water holding capacity. What is the potential to use that at scale? What's the role of the water companies with this in this conversation? And we'll also be hearing from the National Farmers Union, who are working. They have a national water resources specialist, and she's going to be talking about the conversations that are happening at a national level with government to really sort of demonstrate that farmers are being very responsible with water use, but this is a real limiting pinch point for their business. So we're going to be just unpacking how tech can contribute to that conversation.
I always like the name of the Western Growers Center for Innovation and Technology, you know, because everything is not technology. So thinking about water, you've talked about water in the context of innovation around, you know, whether it's practices or, you know, policy, et cetera. A question I have is, what does the technology play look like in this? You know, there's nothing on the horizon that we're going to see the clouds and get, you know, we're going to produce more water. But where exactly is the technology in this process? Because I think back to, you know, when the innovation first started, and technology was more software that allowed you to keep score very accurately of what you had. And that's necessary. And it's got increasingly necessary in the world we live in. But where is technology in all this?
I think, if I'm completely candid, it's probably less of a solution than we probably hoped it would be 8-10 years ago. It's certainly in the mix. It's in the conversation, whether it's smart irrigation, where you've got sensors that are then talking to the irrigator, that's all the drip that's then, you know, feeding back a sort of feedback loop from the plant, the crop to the irrigator. Whether it's desalinization, but that's still very expensive, very energy intensive. As I said, composites and conditioners that you add to the soil. So I think that the big gains are probably, in all honesty, not going to be made by adoption of technology. They're going to probably be made more by behavioral change and us all as consumers learning to consume less and use less. You know, there's a move in the UK, every house, they're trying to get us all to have smart water meters now. And you would be surprised at the number of people that are still resisting having a smart meter installed, you know, around their personal water consumption. So we've been very profligate. I think it's almost up there with food. You know, we've just been so used to, you know, yeah, there's loads of rain. Oh, you know, there's puddles lying on the floor. Why could this possibly be a problem for anybody? And we've just not been very good at storing it. The aquifers are empty. You know, we're hearing farmers have been sinking boreholes that are now A, very salty, and B, dry, because, you know, they're taking what they can out and there isn't much left. So the situation is getting worse and worse. The technology, I don't think, has developed fast enough to be able to ameliorate some of those challenges. So we're left with the really somewhat unpalatable solution that we need some pretty drastic change across the piece. And obviously, agriculture is disproportionately affected as an industry because of the volumes of water that we use. So the role of technology, sadly, I think it's not the silver bullet that people thought it was, you know, a decade ago. We can't tech our way out of this problem.
I couldn't agree more with you. I've, you know, water's been top of the conversation list for so many years. And you always come back to the same irrigation, drip irrigation. It's like this is the conversation that we have. Water, the water sensors, and drip irrigation. And that's it. It's like, this is what we have to hang our hat on around water. Yeah. So I totally agree with you. And I'm curious, one of the things that agriculture has kind of come under fire with these major California droughts that we've been experiencing because of the water usage and, you know, how much agriculture consumes. And in so many ways, it's just developed this negative connotation around farming and farmers and such. So are you seeing similar sort of headlines? Any input on how how we can kind of combat that here?
I don't think there's quite such a blame game, if I want to call it that. But, you know, reports are very candid about the high proportion of water use that farmers and agriculture in general, you know, do draw from the system. There is a narrative going on, and I'm not saying I necessarily agree or disagree with this, but, you know, vertical farming, particularly among the investors, is being hailed as an alternative solution to reduce water use. And I think for some crops, that's correct. In some places, for some crops, in some markets, that is a solution. But, you know, as consumers, you know, I know when I was last in Sacramento, you know, the fields and fields of rock melons, you know, they're pretty thirsty. We like potatoes here. They're pretty thirsty too. So, you know, as society, we like these very crops that are very high demand on water. So I don't think we're seeing farmers vilified as such as being, you know, the big bad users. But I wouldn't be surprised, you know, societies have rioted for less. You know, the UK, as we speak at the moment, in the middle of January 2003, we have a lot of strikes across a number of industries around pay and conditions. You know, we hear that we're only, is it 5 or 6 meals away from anarchy? If, you know, we saw some of this with supply chain demands during the pandemic when people couldn't get their hands on fresh fruit and vegetables. So, you know, society's quite finely balanced. So we're not hearing that at the moment, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see water wars. You know, if you see somebody watering their lawn in the middle of a drought, people will dob them in because, you know, it's going to get an increasingly precious resource. I mean, it is a precious resource, let's be clear, but I don't think we value it enough yet.
You know, it's interesting, you know, when you laid out in the beginning, because both Candace and I, you know, if we're doing current events, we're certainly sitting in the middle of too much water and there's a drought. And then, you know, I was watching a news report last night of how much water is actually, you know, going out into the ocean and not being captured. You know, so I've always felt fundamentally water, the water conversation is policy and infrastructure, yeah, fundamentally. But no, Candace is right. You know, everything seems to circle back to irrigation. What I do think water has done, though, is, you know, that idea of we have to do more with less. It certainly has set up all the tools of precision ag and big data. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a positive thing. So I certainly think it's influenced technology in a good way.
Sure. And breeding, I mean, new varieties that have increased drought tolerance. And also there's, you know, maybe we will be growing different crops. We're doing an event in a couple of months on novel crops for a changing climate. No, you know, not only to broaden the rotation, but also, you know, should we be looking at growing things like millet in the UK that perhaps have an increased drought tolerance? And we're even seeing this in domestic gardens. You know, gardening magazines are saying, here's some crops to grow in your garden for when there's a hosepipe ban, you make your garden even a bit more drought tolerant.
Well, it's interesting. And, you know, just our previous guest, you know, their words ring in my mind, you know, as you mentioned that. So one of the, you know, good sized grower in our neck of the woods, he's looking at agave because it doesn't use, yep, a lot of water. So it's kind of like, watch out, Mexico. We're going to compete on tequila pretty quick. You know, that type of thing. Or we're going to expand the category. You know, we like rising tides that lift all boats. We're not confrontational by nature. Maybe competitive, but not confrontational. I think you're absolutely right. Well, this has been a terrific conversation, ranging from space tech meets ag tech to your worldview, and then a problem seemingly we all share, water. We want to give you the last word. Did we miss anything? Anything you'd like to tell your friends across the pond? I can vouch for all of your events are terrific, And if they get a chance to attend remotely, they or even in person, of course, they should do that. But I want to give you the last word.
Well, you're very kind, Dennis. I guess I would say, you know, our mission in life, we're a membership organization and we have members from all over the world. We want to connect our members with best in class. And certainly the conversations that we always have with you and colleagues from the Western Growers Association, you're the epitome of best in class. And I think with our shared challenges and our shared passion for moving the dial on doing this all better, in a more environmentally benign way, more efficiently, more healthily, I think we're an unbeatable combination. So we love working with you. Let's continue to work together and let's continue to have conversations like this, because I think this is where some of the solutions are going to emerge from.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. You know, one of the things I've been struck by is to your point, not only should we work together, we have so much in common. And and that really reinforces why to do that. Candace, even though it's a raspy voice, and though I can still tell it's you, any last thoughts from you?
No, it's just been such a pleasure. And I feel like you wrapped it up so nicely just about the need to collaborate and work together. And there's so many common challenges and we really are stronger together. So thank you so much for being here today.
Belinda,
my
thanks
absolute
for
pleasure.
Yeah, nope. Thanks for sharing your evening. You're after five. So we appreciate that. Always great to see you. And we'll talk soon. And best of luck with the water conference. We'll be following that one closely.
Thank you. Best of luck with your biologicals conference. We'll be following that closely too.
Good, good. So well, you know, we even hope to see a few folks over here. So anyway, this has been another episode of Voices of the Valley. Candace, I don't know about you. I liked it so much. I think we ought to do it again next week.
I can't wait.
Sounds good. All right. See you next week, everybody. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Voices of the Valley podcast, brought to you today by Reedley College. To learn more about Reedley College's Agriculture and Natural Resources program and the courses offered in Ag Technology, Food Safety, and Plant Science, you can visit reedleycollege.edu.